Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Who hasn't asked for proof or claimed to have a theory or maybe defended their behavior as being hardwired? We've all done it. Were we using those terms correctly? Probably not. Today's show is all about our relationship with language, and we're kicking it off with Annalee Newitz. She's editor-in-chief at IO9, Gawker Media's science fiction blog. She asked a group of scientists about their pet peeves when it comes to misusing scientific terminology.
Well, one thing I want to say is that it's not that people are misusing these terms in everyday life. It's just that for scientists, a word like proof has a very different meaning from what we use in our everyday lives. And it's almost actually the opposite meaning. So when we say to each other, you know, do you have proof that this glass is full of ice? What we mean is there an absolute truth to that fact? You know, can you show me the glass of ice and, you know, measure it with some kind of measuring device and say, yes, it's full? But for a scientist, the thing is that you can never have something be absolutely true, because for a scientist, truth is something that you are constantly testing, and it's always based on gathering evidence. And that's something that's hard for us, because we want things to just be true or false.
Hmm. Another sort of sticky or gray area there is the idea of a theory. So what, Annalee, is the difference between a scientific theory and, say, having a theory about, you know, how the dog keeps getting out of the yard?
Right. So I think when we say theory in everyday life, we often mean, you know, I have rank speculation, or I just sort of pondered something and I'm not really sure if it's true. But for a scientist, a theory is about as close as you can get to something being true. You know, things like gravity are theories, even though, you know, 100% of the time when you drop an apple on someone's head, it will crash onto their head and probably make a bonking noise. It's still a theory because, well, for a scientist, you know, maybe there's some aberrant case in which dropping the apple wouldn't result in gravity pulling it down onto someone's head, in which case we want to be able to revise that theory. We don't want to say it's absolutely true, because that leaves us in a position of not being able to do science, because science is about questioning everything. But like I said, when you hear a scientist say that something is a theory, that basically means they think it's true. You know, they probably wouldn't admit it if you pushed them up against the wall. They'd say, well, but it could always maybe be proven false with other kinds of data, although they probably wouldn't use the word proven. But but really, a theory is the word within science for truth, and which is really the opposite of how we use it in daily life.
Well, I guess that's the problem. There aren't a lot of absolutes in the way that scientists approach things. So what happens when we have words like natural and organic? These things get bandied about all the time, especially when it comes to food. But you can say that something is natural and be dangerous, like snake venom. So talk to me a little bit about the problem with how these two terms often get misused.
Yeah, and these were words that came up a lot when I talked to scientists, organic especially, because organic has a meaning in science, which is basically anything that contains carbon. So you could be munching on a pencil and having an organic breakfast. please don't do that. but you could be. But it also has a meaning outside of science. It has a meaning in marketing. Foods are marketed as organic, and that actually has a meaning. And various regulatory agencies have a meaning that they've assigned to organic for people who are growing food and raising animals. So those definitions, oftentimes when people use the marketing definition of organic, they mistake it for the scientific definition. They believe that there's some kind of scientific verification that whatever they're eating is healthy, which is absolutely not true. There is no scientific notion of healthier food that is natural or organic. And if you talk to scientists who study biology, what they'll tell you is that, in fact, sometimes when things are natural, which is to say naturally occurring, they are very dangerous. Snake venom is a great example. Many kinds of poisons are absolutely natural. Don't eat deadly spiders is a really good piece of advice, even though they're absolutely natural and might fit the definition of organically farmed. But at the same time, lots of things that are unnatural, lots of medicines that we've invented, for example, insulin, those are things that are synthetic, and they're, of course, quite beneficial. And so the idea that you can divide the world into things that are bad and synthetic and good and natural or good and organic is profoundly unscientific. Like I said, it's perfectly legitimate as a marketing term, but please don't get it confused with science. And I think many scientists would rest easier if they knew that we were refusing to confuse those ideas.
And Aline Newitz is straightening us out. She's talked to a number of scientists about some of their pet peeves or some of the terminology that gets thrown around in our daily language that has supposedly scientific meaning but is probably not being used in quite the right way. Well, let's get to one other one, learned versus innate. Why does evolutionary biologist Marlene Zuk, I'm assuming that's how you say her name, have to say about her pet misuse?
So Marlene is an evolutionary biologist. So she deals all the time with people saying that certain traits, like personality traits or skills, are things that are just innate, meaning that somehow some people are just born with certain abilities and other abilities are learned as we grow up. It's kind of a nature versus nurture idea. The terms get thrown around a lot in the media. You hear a lot about certain traits being learned versus certain traits being innate. And the fact is that what we know now from evolutionary biology is that it's very, very difficult to separate those two things out. There's a lot of traits, everything from diseases to skill sets that you may be born with a genetic predilection for, but you'd need a specific environment to activate that genetic sequence of events. And so the interaction between our genes and our environment is very complex, and it's something that we still don't entirely understand. But what we do know is that you really can't say that there's any particular skill that is learned versus innate. It's not a realistic distinction. And so it just drives evolutionary biologists nuts when you say things like, this is a hardwired skill, or women are just hardwired to feel a certain way, and you know, men are just hardwired to do something else. Those are all meaningless terms scientifically. There's no hardwired, unless you're talking about things like being hardwired to breathe, in which case, okay, roll with that.
All right. I'm going to say guilty on a couple of counts. How about you? Fess up. Have you been misusing any of these terms, Annalie?
I think the one that I misused the most is a mathematical term, actually, the term statistically significant, which for a really long time, I thought that that just meant that it was something that was significant, you know? And it turns out, actually, as the mathematician I spoke with, Jordan Ellenberg, said, actually, really, it should be more like statistically noticeable or discernible. It just means anything that is more noticeable than zero. So it can be something that's, you know, a tiny fraction of a percentage point away from zero in order to be statistically significant. So that's one thing that I really had to change my thinking about.
There are others on the list: gene, survival of the fittest, quantum weirdness that we are not going to get to. But Annalie, I want to thank you for bringing us through those that are significant, statistically discernible anyway.
Thank you very much for having me.
Annalie Newitz, editor-in-chief at IO9, Gawker Media Science and Culture Blog. She's also author of Scatter, Adapt, and Remember: How Humans Will Survive a Mass Extinction. We were talking about her article, 10 Scientific Ideas Scientists Wish You Would Stop Misusing. You can find a link to read that for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Imagine trying to learn astrophysics without using the word light year, or studying biology without being able to say photosynthesis. That is the dilemma facing deaf students pursuing a career in the sciences, fields where new terminology is coined and communicated on a daily basis. Douglas Quenqua is a freelance writer whose work has appeared in Wired, Fast Company, and primarily in the New York Times, where he wrote about how users of American Sign Language are collaborating to catch up with scientific vocabulary. Douglas, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
Up until now, how have deaf students communicated terms that they're studying?
It's a lot of improvisation. There's a lot of spelling that goes on. If there's an interpreter in the room, generally what they'll do is the interpreter will probably start out spelling, fingerspelling the terms, and maybe if they have time, they'll agree upon something. You know, they'll say, okay, well, going forward, this will be our sign for organism. This will be our sign for photosynthesis. The problem with that is that everybody then is using their own signs, and when, you know, two hearing impaired people get together and want to talk about the sciences, they are not necessarily using the same words, so to speak. So it's always been a less than ideal solution.
Times Interactive has a little feature comparing some of the terms that we'd find fairly common. I'm thinking adhesion, absolute zero, light year. It takes a great deal of time to spell out, and then on the other side of the screen, there's somebody signing it. Is there a process for the newly signed terms to become official, you know, sort of like a lexicon?
Right. Yeah. You know, it's funny. I went into this thinking that there was some sort of board or some sort of authority that oversaw sign language that could make new signs and say, okay, this will be the sign for this going forward. But it was kind of ignorance on my part because it's like any other language. You can't, you know, there's nobody out there that can say, this is the new word we're all going to be using for this from now on. So the way it's happening is it's coming from the ground up, which it sort of has to. You have these new new forums online where people are contributing their ideas for what new signs for scientific terms should be. Whether they get adopted is sort of determined by, you know, whether they become popular, whether they enter the regular use, just like with any other language.
Interesting. Science, deaf scientists apparently used to use videotape, so now they're using the internet, I guess.
Yeah. I think that's one of the reasons that this problem has persisted so long. I think starting in the 70s, people tried to address this issue by exchanging videotapes with signs of scientific terms. They also used manuals. That process had obvious disadvantages to it, and it's probably not a surprise that not a lot of terms ever wound up getting adopted. So it's really kind of a new thing that, you know, now with the boom in broadband and web video, that you now have the ability to put these things online and just have somebody say, here's a short video of me doing a sign for photosynthesis, and people can they can watch it and they can react. They can comment. They can say, I don't like this. I do like it. And one of the great forums for these things is run by Washington University. And it's sort of a wiki. You know, it's like a Wikipedia sort of system where and it actually, I guess, pulls a little bit from Reddit.com as well. People can vote up or down the signs that they like.
Uh-huh.
So it's very democratic.
And the scientific community, of course, is international. So do American and British and, say, Indian signers have to agree upon these things?
They do not, no. There are separate forums online for British Sign Language and for American Sign Language. I can't say that I know about Indian Sign Language, but I think it's you know, like any other language. I think that they'll worry about communicating with people in other countries after they can figure out how to communicate with each other first.
So as you said, basically it's street use or lab use, I guess that would be the better term, you know, how people use it, how they adopt it. But I'm thinking of all these scientific terms with tiny distinctions between Y's and C's and X's. I mean, it's difficult for people with full capacity for hearing. How did they get through those little bumps?
You know, it's not easy. And I think that it's one of the many, you know, people who are hearing impaired or deaf are obviously already at somewhat of a disadvantage when it comes to learning technical fields. And I think that this is one of those things that has really held them back for a long time. And it may not seem like a huge problem overall, but if you're hearing impaired and you want to go into the sciences, it is a big problem. It's too much improvisation. It's too much making it up as you go along. And, you know, it's a big problem as well for people in science education, because there's already a worldwide shortage of STEM educators. So if they're going to create more science, you know, technology, engineering, and math teachers, they don't want to be eliminating an entire group of perfectly capable people just basically on a technicality.
Well, Douglas Quinquay, I want to thank you for your time.
Thank you.
And that's the freelance writer Douglas Quinquay there. There's more on language and the sciences at wordofmouthradio.org. And when we come back, how language travels from place to place. We're going to investigate the origins of the phrase keep calm and carry on and discover why more words and phrases are borrowed from English than from any other language. That's when Word of Mouth continues after the break.
Woo!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Keep calm and carry on. Keep calm and blog on. Keep calm and call mom. The slogan, conceived to boost the morale of Britons on the brink of World War II, has been adapted for everything from crafting to escaping zombies. It exploded onto T-shirts and mugs after a pair of English bookshop owners discovered one of the vintage posters in a box. The internet took it from there. Henry Irving wrote an article about the origins of the famous phrase for The Conversation and joins us to explain how the formula promoting a stiff upper lip rocketed to worldwide fame. Henry, thank you for joining us.
Oh, that's quite all right. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Tell us the story of the discovery in Northumberland of the Keep Calm and Carry On poster.
Yeah, well, it's a very interesting story, actually. It's two antiquarian bookshop owners in a very small village called Alnwick, which is a very pretty village in Northumberland in the northeast of England, came across one of the posters almost by accident at the bottom of a box of books that they'd bought at an auction. And they seemed to come across this, weren't really sure what it was, but liked the design so much that they decided to put it up in their shop. And they soon had so many people asking them about the provenance and about whether there were copies available that they started producing their own versions. And really, the popularity of the poster grew from there.
Well, what is the provenance of the poster?
Well, the poster itself was designed in 1939. It was designed as part of a series of three posters, which would be issued by the British government if war were to be declared. So this was part of wider preparations for the Second World War. The thing about the poster, though, which is, I suppose, quite interesting, is that it wasn't actually displayed during the war itself. Most of the copies were destroyed, and only a couple have survived, and it's one of those copies that they found in the box.
It was never used then. Why?
There's quite a lot of confusion about this, and one of the issues that we've been looking at in our current historical project on the Ministry of Information is trying to understand why certain materials were made but never used. And the thing about the Keep Calm, Carry On poster is that the tone was never seen to be quite right. So there were a lot of fears that this was not the right message, that it wasn't the right time, and that it simply wouldn't be heeded by the British public.
What do you mean the tone was not right? I mean, now it seems to symbolize everything absolutely British. You know, keep calm, carry on.
Quite. I think this is one of the really interesting paradoxes about the poster, because it says so much about that sort of British sense of restraint, that almost sort of stiff upper lip attitude. But during the preparations for the Second World War, it was seen as being quite impersonal, quite passive. And actually, the public were seen to be wanting something much more active, something which would allow them to really get involved. And it was those questions that really led them to decide not to issue this poster when war was declared in September 1939.
To our ears now, or our eyes now, it may seem very, I don't know, Orwellian in a way, you know, reinforcing behavior by means of a poster.
Yeah, quite. And this is really one of the issues that's at the heart of our project. So the Ministry of Information that was responsible for the Keep Calm and Carry On poster, this was the ministry that gave George Orwell the inspiration to create the Ministry of Truth in the novel 1984. So there are those real Orwellian overtones throughout a lot of this work.
Okay, so the tone wasn't quite right by the wartime government, but isn't that exactly what makes it so applicable to so many other uses?
I think so. And certainly as we've been doing research into the poster and thinking about the way that it's become such a sort of cultural icon in recent years, it's the fact that it can be sort of turned to so many different uses that's really helped with that. I mean, the design is obviously important. The fact that this is all text, that means that it's very easy to manipulate. But then in terms of its actual, the tone, the tempo and the way that it sounds, it can be very easily manipulated by people, applied to a whole range of different products and different scenarios.
Henry, you mentioned that it was one in a series of posters. What were some of the other sayings or slogans?
Well, to begin with, Keep Calm and Carry On was designed as one of three posters. The first read, "Your courage, your cheerfulness, your resolution will bring us victory," which is quite a mouthful.
Cheerfulness leads to victory. Interesting.
That's quite right. And then the second was, "Freedom is in peril, defend it with all your might." The first, which was the Your Courage poster, that was again criticised for being quite impassive and also for almost enforcing a class distinction between your courage and our victory. Mm. And then the Freedom is in Peril poster was seen as being far too academic, too abstract. Again, didn't really give people anything to latch onto. Mm-hmm. So both of them were quite notable for being a flop.
And as if Britons wouldn't be courageous and cheerful as it was.
And that's quite right. There was a real fear that people would be angry that their courage was being doubted, angry that they were being told what to do by a government in London. And I think it is really important to bear that in mind. This is an era when mass communication was coming to the fore, but there was still a bit of a hesitancy and still a real disdain for anything that could be labelled as propaganda.
There was a copyright battle over the design beginning in 2011, so I guess a full decade after its discovery. Who does own it?
One of the really interesting questions that we've still not been able to completely clear up. Now, anything which is produced by the British government is officially covered by Crown copyright. One of the interesting things about this poster and many of the others is that because they were produced almost in secret by a quasi-government department, there's a lot of questions over whether Crown copyright actually applies. The British government don't claim ownership of the poster. They see it as being in the public domain. But the copyright battle was almost sort of precipitated by that because it meant that the rights were almost up for grabs. So when the poster was rediscovered in 2001, you had two competing claims for ownership. I think the UK courts decided that nobody owned it, but the situation in Europe and also in America was slightly more contested, which led to that very fierce copyright battle in 2011 to 2013.
Do you have any favourite variations on the phrase?
Oh, that's a very difficult question. I think my favourite variation is probably the sign that I used to pass on my way to work that said, keep calm, order signage. I think it's just so abstract that it's probably my favourite version.
What was that for, like an engraver or something?
It was for an engravers, yes.
It just rolls off the tongue. Henry Irving, what a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Lovely to speak to you. Thank you, Virginia.
Henry Irving wrote an article about the almost lost slogan, keep calm and carry on for the conversation. You can find a link to read the original article and see some of our favorite variations on the phrase. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. Native English speakers with little or no fluency in languages other than Pig Latin, they have a tough time traveling abroad. Signs and menus are bewildering, asking for directions close to hopeless. You are bound to recognize a couple of words, like Wi-Fi, hamburger, or jazz. That's because English has one of the highest percentages of loaned words. Joining us to discuss the language's largesse is freelance writer and editor Britt Peterson. She's also word columnist for the Boston Globe, and that's where we found her article, her column, English, Loan Word Champion of the World. Britt, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.
So you discovered the comfort of recognizing a familiar word amongst challenging ones when you went to Finland recently. Now, did you know any Finnish at all before you set out on your trip?
Not a single word. I guess I knew sauna, which I pronounced wrong, sauna. But other than that, I mean, Finnish is incomprehensible. It's not an Indo-European language. It's not even one of those languages that you can kind of, if you know a couple words, you can kind of sound out other ones. I'd been to Sweden before, and Swedish, if you know English and maybe you know a little bit of German, Swedish is, it kind of sounds like a little bit of slurred English. Finnish is completely different. It's like Klingon, but with more umlauts. It's literally like an alien language.
In this collection of consonants, there were some words that sounded or looked English enough that you could recognize them. What were some of them?
Right. So every now and then you'd be looking at a menu or something, and there'd be all these words that just a million K's, a million U's, a million P's. And then all of a sudden you'd see muffinsy, and you'd be like, okay, yes, thank God, muffins. I can order that. I'd be walking by a sign, and I'd see hot yuga. That was one. And you'd say, oh, okay. I know what that is. That's a hot yoga class. I saw CrossFit somewhere. So a lot of people in Finland speak English. Basically, everyone speaks English pretty much fluently. And although there is actually a body in Finland that regulates the use of Finnish and often translates English loanwords into Finnish and creates Finnish spellings for them, there are a tremendous number of borrowings from English into Finnish.
Now, that the Finnish government is not the only government that's becoming a little bit more protective about its language. But first, help us understand how English, or when English, became this leading exporter of loan words.
So this is a fairly new thing, relatively, in the course of human history. For a long time, English was really a sponge of words from other languages. In the early days, in the medieval days, English was borrowing from Norse, from the Vikings. You know, it had the Norman conquest, so French, it had Latin. There's a tremendous number of Arabic words in English from trade with Islam tribes, from the Crusades. You know, there's so many words that we don't even think about. Sugar, candy, lemon, lime, mattress, magazine are all Arabic words. So there were many, many centuries during which English was actually taking in many, many more words than it was borrowing. But then Britain became an empire, and it started exporting words all around the world. You can actually, in some ways, track sort of the political arc of an empire, or in some ways a language, by looking at the history of its loanwords. And English really went from being sort of a low prestige language in the Middle Ages to being a very high prestige language after the Renaissance.
Some of these frequently loaned words seem relatively recent. I'm seeing internet, Wi-Fi, hamburger, okay. When did that happen?
Right. So today, there's a lot of technology words, there's a lot of food words that there might just not be words for in other languages. I mean, you know, Vietnamese isn't necessarily going to have a word for internet. So when America started exporting a lot of technology and a lot of pop culture, there were a lot of countries that just simply didn't have words for these concepts. And so they exported the English word to make up for a gap in their language.
Well, there may be some credibility, I guess you could call it, in being on top in terms of loaned words. Not everybody is keen to accept those loans. Why is that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, I think it's partly because of the history of loanwords coming during a time of conquest. You know, again, if you look at Vietnamese has a ton of borrowed words. And that's because for centuries, Vietnam was under occupation. It has a lot of loanwords from China. It has a lot of loanwords from France. It has a lot of loanwords from English. So there's a perception, and I think it's a real perception, that loanwords come in through subjugation. But I think it also, with English specifically, it comes in through anti-Americanism. I mean, I do think there's sort of a taint in that when you read things from France or from China, that there's a sense that their language is this very sort of pristine cultural object, and these American words are really sullying it. They're this sort of dirty Wi-Fi, email, you know, hamburger, things that like are just a little bit gross. You know, this language is a cultural product in China or France or in Iceland. And to bring in a word from outside is, you know, an unfortunate taint on the language.
I've actually heard that there is a ministry in France that helps to protect against words like le weekend. Is that true, or is that an urban
legend? Yeah. So the Académie française regularly publishes articles sort of blasting Anglo-Saxonisms. They ran an article last year saying that they wanted to reconquer the French language. But at the same time, what's actually quite interesting is that French people use English words all the time. I mean, you know, le weekend, le shopping, le smoking is the French word for a tuxedo from smoking jacket. So there's an interesting gap in all of these countries, most of these countries really, between the sort of a very small cultural elite that really blasts English loan words and then the actual use on the ground, which is often very open and very sort of friendly to these often very useful, very convenient English loanwords.
You mentioned a similar government body in Finland. So what do linguists think of these efforts? You know, governments kind of trying to stamp out on loanwords.
I spoke to a linguist, David Crystal, who's tracked this project in Wales. And the Gaelic languages are very small and embattled, and they're sort of trying to revitalize themselves after many years of not being spoken at all. And he sees language purism as actually kind of counterproductive sometimes because it can alienate younger speakers of a language. So if you're someone who really wants to talk about pop culture, you want to talk about food, you want to talk about things that are modern, and you have a government body saying, don't use a word to talk about music, don't use a word to talk about fashion, don't use a word to talk about technology, you're going to rebel against that body. You're going to want to keep on using your slang. It's similar in China where the you know, the Chinese government is constantly saying, you know, don't use Wi-Fi, don't use VIP. But there's a, there's an element of rebellion among the young people when they actually go on using these words. And it creates sort of a dichotomous situation between the actual speakers and a more repressive government.
Well, Britt, thank you very much. Appreciate your time.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on.
Britt Peterson is the word columnist for the Boston Globe. You'll find a link to her article, English, Lone Word Champion of the World, at wordofmouthradio.org. And we continue our exploration of language with a familiar musical term, rock and roll. We know it when we hear it, but what does it actually mean? Thoughtcast Jenny Atiyah has the answer.
Okay, so what does the word rock mean? For starters, it's a noun, as in a stone, and it's also a verb, as in to sway back and forth, hence rock and roll.
We gotta rock, we gotta roll.
But where did these meanings come from? Way back when, in the Hebrew Bible, the word rock was actually a stand-in or symbol for God. So too in the New Testament.
Rock of ages, cleft for me.
God the rock. It kind of makes sense. This hymn dates from the late 18th century. Meanwhile, back in the 9th century or thereabouts, another meaning was brewing, this time in the cold north. The Old English came up with the term rockian, which meant to sway, while the Vikings went with rukia, meaning to move, pull, or tear, and the Germans produced rucken, to move jerkily. The mid-18th century witnessed the appearance of the rocking horse and rocking chair, and a rockabye lullaby was first recorded in 1805. So, how do we get from a nursery rhyme to rock and roll?
Most people are familiar with the phrase rock and roll describing a style of music that really came into its own in the mid-1950s. Before that, it was a lyric used in rhythm and blues songs to describe having sex.
Ken Zambello is a professor at the Berklee College of Music here in Boston.
So for a rhythm and blues song to be about sex, since they couldn't say sex, they had to come up with other phrases. So rock and roll became a way of describing that.
Why don't you rock me? Rock me all night.
The phrase rockin' and rolling was a way to kind of get around censorship.
Love me all night long.
Ooh, squeeze me.
Squeeze me all night long.
After rock and roll became more of an accepted phrase of describing the style of music, the sexual connotation kind of ceased a little bit, and it became much more of a generic term that people could use in lots of different songs and have a much more of a wholesome meaning, I guess. You know, good rockin' tonight was more like, you know, dancing.
1, 2, 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock, rock.
But dancing is a stand-in for sex, isn't it?
Well, it depends on how you're dancing, I suppose.
Rock, we're gonna rock around the clock tonight. Put your bad rags on.
Well, this song's sure easy to dance to. Rock Around the Clock by Bill Haley and his Comets was the first rock and roll record to reach the top of the pop charts. So, rock and roll had its heyday. But what's this business with hard rock? Is it a merging of the Rock of God, of Gibraltar, and of Granite with the rolling we engage in on the dance floor? Actually, hard rock is hard because it's hard on the ears. Rumble by Link Wray dates back to 1958. And finally, rock is also apparently short for rockfish, which is, in other words, a striped bass. That usage dates back to 1690. Oh, and let's not forget Rock Hudson and Stone Phillips. That's it for this week's Word of the Week. I'm Jenny Atiyah.
After the break, language and learning. We're going to talk about how to raise avid readers in the age of the tablet and the ebook, and discover how thinking and speaking in a second language could actually change your personality. It's all still to come on Word of Mouth from NHPR.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Jason Bogue loves books. As a toddler, he was a frequent visitor at the local library in Lyons, Michigan. He continued reading and writing his way to a journalism degree at NYU, spent 5 years as the publishing editor for Media Bistro, where he covered books and publishing. Then he became a dad. Jason and his wife wanted their daughter, Olive, to love books, but knew she'd be born into a world full of screens and digital devices. So Jason wrote a book. He talked to doctors and authorities on child development, education, and literature to get the latest advice on encouraging today's kids to read. The result is Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age.
Basically, when you're reading a book to a child, you really have to make it an interactive experience for them. You need to ask questions about the colors, about the feelings that the characters are having. And if you have a child that's not even ready to talk about these things, you can point and you can help them interact with the text itself. That interaction is one of the most important things you can do for a growing child's brain.
Well, there are 15 points to this interactive reading, and we can't go through all of them individually, so we'll just kind of use that as a lens for this entire conversation. First, when do you start reading to a kid?
I tell people that those first couple weeks, just do it. I mean, reading is a set of motions. We all think that we were kind of readers, that it's in our blood or something like that, but it's not. It's a set of motions that you were taught by your parents or the caregivers, the people that cared to share books with you. Earlier this, about a month ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics actually put out recommendations telling pediatricians to start informing parents of this very fact, that you should just be reading from infancy onward with your child.
And you write that kids can interact with books at 6 months. Interact? Really? How?
This is actually the very first piece of evidence I collected myself for the book. I had been reading to my daughter this book called Lost and Found, and I had been reading that book to my daughter for a few months, and she just sits there. I don't know how many people in the audience have experience with newborns. They just sit there. They don't do anything. They're very mute. But I could see her eyes following it, and about 6 months in, I had been reading this book for a while, and the penguin, there's this triumphant moment when he comes back, and every time I would be interactive, I would highlight that moment with expressive motions, and it was magical. She lit up and she actually squealed for joy. It was the first reaction I had ever seen her have to a piece of text, and it was for me the very first moment that she grasped how a story worked.
You speak to others who've done other research. John Protzko at NYU wrote about how to make kids smarter. Some data from Dr. Grover Whitehurst, who came up with this idea of interactive reading after studying 21 to 35-month-olds. You write about giving kids a leg up by teaching them to read. Any factual data or numbers you can share with us that illustrate that point?
Yeah, the NYU study you mentioned by Protzko, that was the one that really turned me on to this. They looked at about 6 to 8 different studies of child development and found that reading to a child can quantitatively raise their IQ by 6 points. Seeing that number really kind of blew my mind. I mean, in some ways, it is common sense. I mean, we know that reading is helpful and that people that have been reading books, it makes them smarter, but the cognitive gains that happen that early in a child's life, I think it's really important. You can't reiterate it enough that reading really is changing your child's brain, making them smarter, and also just making them more emotionally healthy as they're learning how to explain their feelings and how to actually control those feelings.
Now, you encourage parents to carefully consider how and when they introduce digital devices to kids. We've heard the argument that devices are more interactive than paper books and therefore healthier than watching television, for example. How do digital books and devices fit into this idea of interactive reading?
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that word interactive lately. If you look at any app store right now, you'll see that word interactive batted around many, many times. And there's two senses of the word interactive. There's one, the sense of a device that can interact with its user. The other, more profound meaning for me, is an interaction between two people, and that's what interactive reading means. It's when a human being is talking to another human being. And it turns out, I spoke to neuroscientists about that, it turns out that for a growing brain, the only thing that will help that brain grow, that will carve new neural pathways in the brain, is the human voice. You could have one of these devices reading a book to you, but it would not have the same impact that you see when a human is reading that same book to them.
How do you encourage your kids to read books in an age dominated by screens? Jason Bogue is with us. We've spoken to him many times when he led the Galley Cat blog. Now he's out with a new practical guide to encouraging kids to develop a lifelong love of reading. It's called Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age. Do we have enough data now on when to introduce digital devices to kids? And what did you come away with? Any suggestions?
Yeah, the child development community does not have enough data to conclusively say this is the correct amount of time to spend. I go back to the American Academy of Pediatrics recommendations that were issued a few years ago. I still believe them. I still think they're important. It says no or minimalize screen time before 2 years old. And after that, I wouldn't do more than an hour a day. It's tough. It's not going to make your life easier. These devices are tremendous. Powerful babysitters. And I encourage parents to try to do the same thing and just to really be mindful how much time you're spending on these devices. And the other really, really important thing that numerous experts told me is no devices at bedtime. Let your child know that bedtime is when we read books or when we tell each other stories, but those screens are tremendously disruptive to sleep patterns and just your calming down process.
Well, I imagine that one of the well-thumbed pages in the book will be page 64, How to Avoid Using Devices. Some tactics. But one of the things I enjoyed about the book is that you do know that kids are going to be drawn to apps. They're going to be drawn to electronic books, to television, to other media. So one of the tactics you use is a kind of reading bundle. I'd like to unpack one of those reading bundles now. Here's something to lead us into that may sound very familiar to listeners.
Lemon, don't let them sleep. Be the good girl. You always have to be. Let it go. Let it go.
That's a four-year-old from Brooklyn singing Let It Go, the song from Frozen that is just on just about any kid's lips. So let's explore this idea. Just about every kid in America knows the words to that song. What are some suggestions for launching off of that passion into books?
Yeah, well, Virginia, I first of all, I'm kind of hurt. You should have just asked me to sing that song. I'm perfectly capable of singing it. You don't need to bring on four-year-olds.
You might not be as instantly cute.
No, we sing that song all the time in my house, and it was one of those things. I mean, it comes into your house as an audiovisual thing. It's a movie, and you want to limit that time that she spends watching movies. But she had such enthusiasm for it. And over and over and over, the experts told me the only way children learn is when they're chasing the things that they're interested in. So I looked at this. I said, here's something she's really interested in. What can we do to expand upon that? So I went to the bookstore, and Random House has published tons of Frozen spin-off books. The one that I recommend, after looking at many, many of them, the Frozen Big Golden Book is really the most satisfying out of all of those. It's a way of revisiting a movie and kind of having an interactive reading experience going through the story again on the page. And then after that, you can use, and I started to do this with Olive, there's a number of apps that actually let your child tell a story. My Story, Felt Board, Draw and Tell, Toontastic, these are all really powerful tools for letting your child tell stories with simple digital puppets, simple digital tools that they can draw with. And you can say, hey, I know you love the story of Elsa and Anna. What happens next, and they can actually draw it, or if they can't draw, they can use these little puppets and make voices and record themselves making the sequel to Frozen and continuing that story. It's really cool to watch them learn storytelling that way. And then the thing I've been reminding parents is it's based on Hans Christian Andersen's The Snow Queen, which is a really great fairy tale that I hadn't read in many, many, many years. There's a lot of amazing stuff going on in that story. I found an old-time radio drama adaptation of it, like a 1930s kids show that adapted it. It was really fun. Olive and I spent time listening to that in the car. And then the Great Joukowsky did an adaptation as well, and I found that adaptation with a Russian ballerina reading the story, and Olive was enraptured by the whole thing. And Olive and I sat in the car and spent many hours discussing how love can thaw the frozen heart, which is the message of both Hans Christian Andersen's story and Frozen as well.
Well, Jason, congratulations on the book, and thanks so much for being with us again.
Oh, thank you. It's been a real pleasure. I love being on the show. Thank you.
Jason Bogue, Director of Story Investigation at True Pictures. His new book is called Born Reading, Bringing Up Bookworms in a Digital Age, from picture books to ebooks and everything in between. It features suggestions for the best books and teacher-approved apps for kids from birth to age 5, and there's much more practical advice on his website. You'll find a link to it at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Reading books is an essential ingredient for developing a child's language skills. But what is the value of teaching children a second language? Freakonomics Radio spent an entire episode investigating that very question and discovered some pretty startling data. The average wage increase among multilingual Americans is pretty meager. For native English speakers, it's about 2%. But some of the benefits of picking up another tongue are not so easily quantified. In this portion of the show, host Stephen Dubner discovers how people behave differently when they're thinking in a second language.
We'll start with Boaz Kesar. He's a psychology professor at the University of Chicago. His specialty is communication.
Really, studying communication is entirely autobiographical, because I realized that I'm different when I'm using almost any language other than Hebrew.
Kesar is from Israel. His particular interest in communication has to do with how our decision-making is affected when we operate in a foreign language.
Things like making investments. I'm much more likely to invest in the stock market when I do it in English. If I think about it in Hebrew, I feel that I become more conservative.
So that's surprising. But maybe he thought it was just him. So he ran an experiment with University of Chicago students. It was a little game with money.
So imagine I give you $20.
Here's the way Kesar's game works. If he gives you $20, you will play a game with 20 rounds, dollar a round. In each round, you can either keep the dollar, just put it in your pocket, or put the dollar on the table and flip a coin. If it's tails, you lose the dollar, but if it's heads, you get $2.50, meaning your original dollar back, and you win a dollar and a half.
So you don't need to know a lot of math to realize that the expected value is positive. In other words, that on average, you're better off with a bet than pocketing the dollar.
Now, what does this have to do with a foreign language?
We will... interested to see what happened when you make this decision when you're using a foreign language.
So the researchers had some students play in English and other students play in a foreign language, Spanish.
And turns out, indeed, people were like almost 20 percentage points more willing to take bets. They were significantly more willing to take the risk in a foreign language.
That isn't at all the result that he was expecting.
I was actually stunned that it happened. Because it's really the same person. All that person does is use Spanish now, and it's the same dollar, it's the same person, and it was just randomly the case that you're doing it in Spanish.
Now, it could be that people just didn't understand as well in a second language, that this was more of a comprehension issue than a risk issue. But Kesar, at least, was persuaded that he was onto something.
Because of that, we started thinking that maybe it's an even stronger and more pervasive phenomenon than we even think, and not just about risk. And indeed, we find that there's all sorts of systematic differences that exist when you're using a foreign language.
For instance?
Like when we ask people to think about moral dilemmas. So would you sacrifice one person to save five?
You've heard this kind of dilemma before, right? A bus driver, let's say, is going to run over five people and kill them. So do you go ahead and kill the driver before he can kill the other five? Now, normally, people are reluctant to say yes. But if you ask them in a foreign language...
We found that people are twice as likely to do that, to actually go for the utilitarian option, to sacrifice one person to save five. Now, we didn't do this for real. used hypothetical scenarios, but still, they said, yes, I will do that.
So why might this happen?
Now, the reason this could be interesting is that we know that the foreign language is much less emotional. It gives you less emotional resonance when you use it. The same word, love and amour, even though you know exactly the meaning, and you know the meaning when the meaning is identical, you still, if you're a native English speaker, you get a lot more out of love. And that's been demonstrated in all sorts of ways. There are also physiological reactions, so you can show that people's arousal is higher when they use their native tongue when these kind of emotional related words are used.
And so, Kesar says, when people think in a foreign language,
they're more reflective about their choices. They're more likely to engage in cost-benefit analysis, in a way, and less likely to be swayed by all sorts of emotional reactions that they might have in general.
And that was an excerpt from the podcast Freakonomics Radio. There's a link to hear the full episode on the pros and cons of learning a second language. You'll find it at wordofmouthradio.org. So grateful for your listening time today. Whether you prefer to communicate in English or Mandarin or Pig Latin, or favor writing letters, emailing, or sharing your thoughts by good old word of mouth, we'd love to hear from you. Earlier, we talked about the origins of the phrase keep calm and carry on. Well, what is your favorite variation of the now ubiquitous poster? You can chime in on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. We're going with keep calm and listen to public radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. This is Word of Mouth. Spread it around. We're online anytime at wordofmouthradio.org.